welcome to St. Andrews. My name's Jason. If I haven't met you, I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm really thrilled that you're here this morning. But also for those of you that have joined us as we start 26 with this curriculum called STEPS, where we've launched out into a book written by John Ortberg, who is going to help us to figure out how do we get free from the stuff that is holding us back, and how do we find the freedom that Jesus said was possible. And so if you haven't joined one of those groups, as soon as we're done at the Connect Center, you can walk over there, sign up. Love to have you in one. My group started this week. It has been already powerful conversations talking about how we find what Jesus said was possible. And to help us kick it off this week, my friend, somebody who's had a tremendous influence in my life, probably many of yours, but for decades has helped me understand who Jesus is and fall in love with him, I want you, St. Andrews, to welcome John Ortberg. Thanks, buddy.
Well, thank you, Jason. I feel old and short. Wonderful being with you. Love this church, and I love this time of year. I don't know about you. New Year's, the idea of a fresh start, blank page, New Year's resolutions. It's an amazing thing that we are able to resolve. It's part of the glory of being a human. Most famous speech ever in America, Abraham Lincoln, the Gettysburg Address, we hear highly resolve. So New Year's resolutions, I think, are great. Only one problem. Anybody ever have a problem keeping a New Year's resolution? You know, why is that? We have this amazing ability to make a decision, to make a commitment, to put a stake in the ground. What's our problem? And I kind of want to start there as I walk through what we're going to talk about this morning. The Apostle Paul wrote words real famous to the church at Rome in the 7th chapter, where he talks about, I don't understand myself. Because I know the good things that I want to do, but I find I don't do them. And then there's stuff that I don't want to do, and I say to myself, I'm not going to do that, but I find I do those things. Wait, I don't understand myself. And everybody, that's the human experience. And at the beginning of the new year, very often we'll say, I'm not going to say that, and then I say it. Or I'm not going to buy that, and then I buy that. Or I'm not going to go there, not going to look at that, then I look at it. This year, I'm going to eat differently. When I was growing up, my southern grandmother lived with us for many years, and she had a recipe for popcorn. This is back before there was microwave popcorn. The way that my grandmother would make popcorn is she would fry bacon in a pan, and then she would pop the popcorn in the pan of bacon grease, and then she would cut up the bacon and put it into the popcorn. Nobody in my grandmother's family lived to be very old. Because we all knew we shouldn't eat that stuff, and yet we do. And then we suffer from this at deeper levels. When I was a parent, I had a picture of the kind of dad I would be and the way I would be with my kids and make wonderful memories. And then I would find in the stress of actual life, we took the kids to Kinder Photo one time to have our family picture taken. I thought, well, this will be a fun thing and they'll enjoy this, and they didn't. They were squirrely and scared and badly behaved, and so I tried to bribe them. If you'll smile for the picture, everybody gets a cookie from Mrs. Fields. That didn't work well. So then I tried to threaten them. You kids want to cry? I'll give you something to cry about. And that's a good way to motivate kids to smile for the camera. And finally, I took aside our most distraught kid. She's like 4 years old. She's just losing it. And I said, honey, I bet I know what you wish you had right now. More than anything, you wish you had baby tweezers. That was her favorite doll. She named the doll herself. We don't know why, baby tweezers. I'll bet you wish you had baby tweezers. You know, big tears in her eyes. Just, I said, well, honey, if you ever want to see baby tweezers alive again, then why do I do that? That's not the way the dad I thought I was going to be. Thought I'd be this, you know, fun, jovial, magic, larger-than-life guy. And then I find myself preoccupied or irritated, caught up with my own agenda. For lack of a better word, we all just get stuck. Marriages, relationships, emotions, finances, in our work, in our habits, addictions, stuck happens to people. Now, one day there came into human history a man, and the stories about him say that he had a strange power to help people get unstuck. So there's an adulterous woman who's caught in an affair, guilt and shame and misery. There's a religious leader named Nicodemus, and he's kind of stuck in his self-righteousness. Disciples in a boat that are just stuck in their fear. Tax collector named Zacchaeus, stuck in his greed. Thank God in Orange County there's not a greed problem, but back in the ancient world there were people that could get stuck in stuff like that. And in every case, they couldn't unstick themselves, but strangely they found that when they bound themselves to this man, Jesus, when they abandoned their life and their will and turned it over to him, they found in him their liberation. And this was as he said it would be. He would say these extraordinary things like, "Very truly I tell you, whoever sins is a slave to sin." That's such interesting language. I do stuff I don't want to do, and then I get stuck in it. And then he says, "If the Son," now he's referring to himself, Son of Man, sometimes he would be called Jesus, "if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." Now I want to suggest, nobody on earth ever said stuff like that before. Even religious leaders, the Buddha or Confucius or Muhammad, they would talk about following a sermon. None of them would say, "If I set you free." This man said that, and people experienced it. And what's amazing is he's still doing it. So about 90 years ago, there was a hopeless drunk. Some of you know this story. He is known to history as Bill W., and he hit bottom. Alcohol destroyed his life. He'd been in jail. He'd been hospitalized, I think, 4 times. He'd lost jobs. He'd lost money. He'd lost friends. He'd lost self-respect. He'd promised his wife, Lois, over and over in deep humiliation, "Never again, never again, never again," and then again and again and again. His doctor, Dr. Silkworth, known to history as the doctor who loved drunks, told his wife Lois that she had 3 choices. She could let him die, she could watch him go crazy, or she could have him locked up. And Bill knew this to be true. And then one day there was a knock on the door. A guy named Ebby T. invited Bill into what was essentially a little fellowship of people. They were called the Oxford Group back in those days. They were trying to recapture discipleship to Jesus. And they practiced things like surrender and a real rigorous moral inventory, self-examination, and real raw confession to another person and making restitution, amends when they had done wrong, and learning how to meditate on Scripture and learning how to pray and live a life of service. And Bill W. got into that and began to practice that way of life. And over the next 4 years, something called Alcoholics Anonymous, AA, was born. And eventually he kind of wrote down what were the steps that they had been following. But it all came out of getting a part of this group of people who were just trying to follow Jesus. And he and then Dr. Bob, over the next 4 years, about 100 people discovered if they followed this way of life, they were liberated from an addiction that was hellish and going to destroy them. A lot of people don't know this story. And here's part of what's interesting. Nobody planned this. Nobody got out a whiteboard and said, "Let's try discipleship to Jesus as a methodology for freedom from clinical levels of addiction." It just happened. Just happened. As a matter of historical fact, there's a book called Not God, kind of the classic history of AA, if you're interested in it, by a guy named Ernest Kirst. As a matter of historical fact, whatever you might think of Jesus or his message, there emerged a spiritual way of life through which people who followed it were given the power to be liberated from a fatal addiction. So, if these steps, this way of life, and the principles behind them could bring deliverance and sobriety to a bunch of hopeless drunks, might they not also be helpful for normal, healthy, emotionally mature, uncomplaining, non-judgmental, barely ever sinning, respectable Presbyterians like everybody here in this room? The idea behind this book, Steps, and this talk today is AA got the 12 steps from the church, but now the church needs them back. As you may know, Alcoholics Anonymous groups very often meet in churches. But they generally don't meet in rooms like this one. This is one of the most beautiful rooms to gather and worship and get inspired in. 12-steppers are messy people, so they meet usually in the basement of churches on metal folding chairs, drink bad coffee. But somehow when they meet in just real messy, open, raw ways, a kind of power flows that sometimes doesn't flow in beautiful rooms with beautiful, put-together people. They have a million sayings in AA because they got to make stuff sticky, kind of like Jesus did. Because like Jesus, they knew heaven and hell are at stake in a human life. And one of their sayings, kind of sobering to people who do what I do for a living, they will say, when you go to church, you can go upstairs and hear about miracles, or you can come downstairs and watch them. When I started to study the 12 steps, a friend actually from right here, from Newport Beach, told me, he said, I think it will not be long before you're jealous that you're not an alcoholic. And it wasn't. I came to understand what he meant. So, in the moments that are left in this talk, I would like to go downstairs and have this be kind of a basement meeting, just raw, messy reality. My name is John. I'm a sinner. Now, when someone says that, instead of just letting them, you know, wallow in their misery, the idea is that you all respond by saying, hi, John, with a spirit of welcome and humility and joy and warmth, and that it's in your faces and your voice. So we'll try it one more time. My name is John. I'm a sinner. Thank you. In this community, my friend Mike says, the worse your story, the warmer your welcome. Now, of course, that sounds a lot like Jesus. And that's where the church got born. In this story, in this place, in this room, the worse your story, the warmer. We need you here. So, we'll just look at the first three steps in what's left of this talk. And they look quite forbidding, but don't worry, because the other ones get much worse. They really only work for people who are desperate for help, and that brings us to step one. Step one is, we admitted that we were powerless over our fatal attraction to do wrong. Now, this is, in the actual 12 steps, the only one that mentions alcohol. Only time it's mentioned in all the 12 steps is this one. But you can put in whatever word you want to for you there. We were powerless over fear, greed, lust, anger, resentment, and our lives had become unmanageable. The reason I don't want to do, according to Paul's analysis, is that we deal with a spiritual power. The Bible calls it sin. That's a word that in our day sounds often moralistic or prudish or Victorian, but it simply refers to this reality that my willpower can handle some things in life, but there's something off, there's something broken, I get attached, I'm not who I want to be, and my willpower can't correct it. And as long as my ego's on the throne, I'm doomed. So this is what's really interesting. A lot of people don't understand this. The place where our program starts, 12 Steps, Discipleship to Jesus, the place where it starts is not what people usually think. It's not, I'm going to try harder to follow Jesus. This year, I will resolve to, you know, be nicer or be kinder or be more truthful or try harder to not look at porn or not yell at the kids or not complain about my marriage or not being married or try harder to read the Bible more. The first step is not to try harder to do anything. The first step is to say, I can't. I can't. I'm beat. I need help. I've hit bottom. And nobody likes this because we don't want to feel weak. We want to be strong. We want to be thought of as strong people. When I started high school, I was a little over 6 foot tall, and I weighed 120 pounds. It's not impressive. And things never changed a whole lot for me in the muscle department. Some years ago, my wife Nancy rented a movie for us to watch featuring an action star by the name of Sylvester Stallone. And it was set in the mountains, so everybody wore parkas and jackets through this movie, except for Stallone, who for some reason could not keep his shirt on. And scene after scene, finally, it's the end of the movie, and like for the 12th time, he's dangling from a rope, just enormous biceps and pecs and deltoids rippling off the screen. And my wife looked at him, and then she looked over at me, and then she looked back at him, and then she looked back at me. This is a true story, and she kind of shook her head, and she said, "You know, I've just never been attracted to well-built men." And I knew she intended to make me feel good, but it didn't make me feel as good as what she intended. Because nobody wants to look weak. Here's the truth about me. I am weak. I cannot fix myself. I cannot fix my family. I cannot fix my pain. I don't mean that I used to be weak, but now I've discovered the secret and I'm strong and I'll tell you how to do it. I mean, on my own, I can't. It's a very interesting thing in the 12 steps. When you look through them, not one of the steps is, "I will never drink again. I made the decision, I'll never drink again." I can't. This swims against the tide in our world because our culture will tell you, you can. You got this. You can do anything. And the first step is precisely the opposite. Oddly enough, in AA, they have discovered that the more deeply you feel the pain of your powerlessness and desperation, the better. The closer you actually are to encountering God. It's the people who have felt the pain of life apart from God. This sounds so strange. Addiction, betrayal, humiliation, prison, poverty, terminal disease, place where the church is persecuted, failure, divorce, who get so desperate for God that they just can't settle for anything else. So in the 12 steps, they will sometimes talk about, again, they make everything sticky, the gift of desperation, G-O-D. The gift of desperation. Came to admit, powerless, unmanageable. I was talking to one guy that's taught for decades in 12-step circles, and he said the problem in most churches is people have a wimpy step one. I don't believe I desperately need God. I think I'm doing pretty good. Often in the Bible, you see stories that contrast prodigal son, that's a real robust step one. Elder brother, that's a pretty wimpy step one. Tax collector, won't look up at heaven. Pharisee, I fast twice a week. Thank God I'm not like other people. Give a tithe and everything. Over and over, you see this kind of contrast. This guy I was talking to said, the problem is, as long as you have a wimpy step one, you will have a wimpy steps 2 through 12. Or however many steps you have in your program. Everybody's got a program. It's just a way of life. For better or for worse, on purpose or not, we all got a program. So if you're here today and you feel beaten, weak, desperate for God, I want to tell you, you are in better shape than you think you are. Wonderful writer about the Christian life, Dallas Willard, used to say that God's address is at the end of your rope. That's step one. And now that leads to the second step. Second step is, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So the first step is a step of hopelessness. The second step is a step of hope. Came to believe. But now it's going to have to come from outside of me. And Bill W. and Dr. Bob and millions of other addicts. And now for thousands of years, millions of people, desperate people, have found that it does. Paul put it like this. I just want to think about this statement for a moment because so often we just read over it. Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work in us, to him be glory in the church and in Jesus Christ. And you got to dwell on that for a minute, because Paul's thought through this and he's making a claim. Him who is able, God is able. He's not a distant spectator. He's not an impersonal force. He is active. But it's not just that. It's like Paul's going to just keep pushing on this. God is able to do what we ask. He's not a vending machine, but he's capable of answering prayer. Not just that. He is able to do what we ask or imagine. He is able to do the stuff that we can dream about but wouldn't even think to ask. My wife will sometimes say that her favorite answers to prayer are answers to prayers that she forgot to pray. Not just that. God's not just able to do most of what we can ask or imagine. He is able to do all that we can ask or imagine. Now again, you have to decide what you think about this, but this is what Paul is claiming. No, Paul says, he's bigger than that. He is able to do more than all we could ask or imagine. No, he's bigger than that. He's not just able to do a little more than what we ask or imagine. He's able to do immeasurably more, exceedingly abundantly more. There is simply nothing that is logically possible and consistent with his character that God cannot do. He is able to say, let there be light, and there is light. He is able to calm a storm by saying, peace, be still. He can give a child to an old couple named Abraham and Sarah. He can give a young boy named David victory over a giant, Goliath. He is able to make a drought. He's able to make a flood. He's able to make a rainbow. He's able to provide manna in the morning, water from a rock, food for 5,000 from a few loaves and fishes. He is able to deliver people from impossible situations, a fiery furnace or a lion's den. Not just that, none of his power has diminished. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is able, Bill W. discovered this. He is able to take hopeless, hell-bent alcoholics and give them the power to be free, to be sober. He's able to take dead marriages and breathe life back into them. He is able to take people on death row and fill them with love and hope. I've seen it. He is able to forgive sin, able to heal shame, able to provide meaning, able to supply hope when you are at the end of your rope, able to raise Jesus of Nazareth from the dead and promise a resurrection is coming to this sorry, dark world, came to believe that our God is able. That's step two. So then, and again, I mean, that's wonderful stuff to feel and hear in a moment, but it's worth just thinking about soberly. Paul, you know, wrote those words to our minds so that we might live in our mental maps in the reality of the presence of a God like that. Doesn't mean my circumstances will always turn out the way that I want them to, but it means that's the God of the universe. So, you know, maybe your step today is step one. You're feeling unmanageable. You need to talk to God about that. Maybe it's step two. You're wrestling with believing that there is a God like that. You got to talk to him about that. But if you've taken those two steps, then you're ready for step three. We're never done with the steps, but they're very organic. Each one flows into the next. The third step, if the first two make sense to you, is a step of the will. The first two are in the mind. The third is in the will. Made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And this is very deeply the great invitation of Jesus. Whoever wants to be my disciple, you can do this if you want, you can do this, must deny themselves and take up their cross. All that means to deny yourself, take up your cross, is to say, my desires will no longer be on the throne. I will no longer do something simply, ultimately, because that's what I desire. I will put him and his good first. Follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. And maybe this is your step. Now, you need to understand here, this is a journey. Very often what happens is we may turn our life and our will over to God, and I think I'm surrendered, and what a good thing it is to be surrendered. And I come to a church service and we sing songs about surrender, and oh God, I'm fully surrendered. And then you go out to your car in the parking lot and somebody gets in front of your car and you discover you're not surrendered at all. So the thing is, God will help you with this journey. Years ago, I grew up in Rockford, Illinois. I'd come to California to go to grad school at Fuller, and I went back to Rockford to visit my folks. I was getting a haircut, and the guy cutting my hair, his name was Jim, was asking me what I was doing, and when I told him I was thinking about becoming a pastor, he's really interested. So he was asking me about God and faith. And I told him, I don't live in Rockford, but my folks do, and they lead a Bible study, and if you, your wife, are interested, you could go to that. So afterwards, I was talking to my mom. She used to get her hair done at the same studio. And I said, Mom, Jim and his wife Pam are real interested in God. You should talk to her about faith. My mom said, no, I know Pam quite well. She's married and divorced 5 times. She has a very non-faith-based lifestyle. She is not interested in God. I don't want to do that. And I said, well, you're wrong, and you ought to talk to her. So the next time she went in to get her hair done, she's sitting in the chair. She remembers that conversation, and she sees Pam. So she says a little prayer. She says, God, I don't want to talk to Pam about you, because I know she would not be interested. So if you want me to talk to her about you, you got to give me a sign. Pam walked over to my mom and said to her, Kathy, I understand that you and your husband, John, lead a Bible study. Would it be okay if Jim and I came to it? My mother took that as a sign. And they started coming to this Bible study. And my mom, as she was talking to Pam in the chair on that day, asked her what her background was and found out she was very confused about religion. When she was growing up, one parent was Jewish and one was Catholic. And so one would take her to synagogue, and then when she got home, the other parent would make her go upstairs and say a rosary and ask God to forgive her for going to synagogue. So she wanted no part of religion. And everybody's, yeah, this is a journey. See, turning our life and our will over to the care, it's a journey. God will be involved with this. Pam started drinking when she was 16 years old, drink any guy under a table, cycling in and out of marriages, life's a train wreck. Eventually she got into AA, she got sober, but when she got to step 3, turn our will and our life over to the care of God, she wanted nothing to do with God. So she said, I'm going to call my higher power Ralph. As you may know, AA is kind of spirituality 101. You can do that. You can give your higher power any name you want to. And so she would just call her higher power Ralph. She turned her will and her life over to the care of Ralph. And it wasn't working real good. Marriage thing was the problem. She's kind of white-knuckling it. She went to an AA meeting one day. It's part of why she ended up talking to my mom. She went to an AA meeting one day, and there was a guy there who was just kind of repulsive. He had been drinking. He had retched. He smelled vile. He looked terrible. Nobody wanted to be near him. He was a train wreck. And when it was time for folks to share, he said, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ralph. And it sounds kind of funny to us, but to Pam, it was like a knife in the heart. And she said, that's not my higher power. So, God, you got to introduce yourself to me. And that prayer then led to her talking to my mom, sitting in that chair, and then in Bible study. And eventually she and Jim turned their will and their life over to the care of God, as Jesus has described them. That wasn't the end of the journey. There were more twists and turns and bumps and bruises. But the point is that God will really meet us if we're looking for him and seeking to surrender. Often it's something we have to do over and over. And it says, over to the care of God. Last thing I'll say about this, then we'll wrap it up. You will never do this if you do not believe that God cares for you. And Jesus came very largely to teach us about the God who cares for lilies of the field and sparrows. Does he not much more care for you? Richard Foster, great writer, tells a wonderful story about care from God. It's about a dad in a grocery store with a little kid that's just melting down. Have you ever seen that in a grocery store? You've been there where there's a kid just melting down. One time dad's in a grocery store, his kid's just losing it. He can't do anything. Kid's out of control. So he's just saying softly, "You can do this, Isaac. This is okay, Isaac. I'm going to make it through this, Isaac." And a woman says to him, "I'm amazed how patient you are with your son, Isaac." And he said, no, my son's name is David. I'm Isaac. So, all been there. So Richard writes about this. Dad, kid's just melting down, losing it, crying, screaming, you know, wriggling, wants everything. Dad doesn't know what else to do. So finally, out of desperation, he starts making up a song and singing it to his little boy. "I love you. I'm glad you're mine. I love to see you smile. I love to hear you laugh. I'm so grateful that I get to be your dad." And the little boy gets real quiet. His eyes get real big. His face gets real still. And he's just motionless, rapt, the whole time his dad wheels him in that little grocery cart out of the store, through the parking lot, buckles him into his car seat. And then the boy throws his arms out and says, "Sing it to me again, Daddy. Sing it to me again." And there's this wonderful verse in the Old Testament where the prophet says to the people of Israel that God sings over you, God sings over his people with joy. That's God in you, God in me, God in me. Now, in AA, these first three steps are sometimes summarized like this, because again, they got to make everything real sticky. So the first step, admitted, I'm powerless, over, unmanageable, I can't. Second step, came to believe, power greater than ourselves could restore us, he can. Third step, made the decision, turn our will and our lives over, I think I'll let him. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. So I'm going to ask that we say those three phrases together out loud, because I love that language. And that way, if somebody asks you, what was the sermon about today, you'll be able to tell them, because you will know. Just a real simple summary that you can carry with you at any moment. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. Let's say that together out loud. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. Would you pray together with me? And whatever's going on in your life today, maybe there's a sense of desperation, something's happening to your body or your family, somebody you love, your circumstances, and you feel desperate, just tell him. You're at step one. Maybe you want to believe, but there's doubts and questions. That's part of why St. Andrew's doing the series that it's doing right now. And you just tell them that you're working on step two right now. I want to believe. God, help me. Maybe it's step three. Maybe you've never turned your life and your will over to the care of God. You could do that today. This church would love to help you with that. Or maybe you've turned something over, but you keep taking it back. My worry, my fear, this habit, this dream, my body, my kid, my future. And maybe you just open your hands up right now. Oh yeah, God, I turn my life, my will, this concern, this person, this whatever, over to you. Thank you, God, that you bring freedom and love and power. And I pray that you will help me and everybody listening to my voice, find it this day, manna for today, one day at a time. We pray in Jesus' name, amen.